Hi, good evening, everybody. So we're pleased to have Raj Chetty giving the second of his three lectures, the Lionel Robbins lectures. I actually met Raj many years ago in 2005 when I was visiting Berkeley. And what sort of struck me in the time since is that Raj has sort of managed to combine both theory in public economics with the use of large data sets. And that's sort of an approach which has been spreading from public economics into other fields. And so today we're going to have the second lecture on the sort of overall theme of improving equality of opportunity, but focused today on segregation and housing markets and education policy. So roughly, I think, like yesterday, Raj will speak for between 45 and 50 minutes. And then we'll have time for all of you to ask whichever questions you want to ask at the end. So take it away. Thanks.
All right. So I'm going to talk today about policies to improve upward mobility. And so just to remind you where we left off at the end of the last lecture, we talked about the substantial variation in upward mobility across areas in the United States, with the probability of reaching the top fifth, starting from the bottom fifth, for instance, varying dramatically, much higher in the middle of the country relative to the southeast, and so forth. And we talked about how most of that appears to be driven by the causal effects of childhood environment, and in particular, identified five factors that seem to be strongly correlated with these differences in mobility across areas. So what I want to ask today is how we can improve social mobility in areas with low rates of mobility. And I'm going to focus on two of the five correlations that we talked about in the last lecture, segregation and school quality. And so let me just say a word about why I'm focusing on those two as opposed to any one of the other factors, which are also, I think, very strong predictors of these differences. I think one of the reasons is that it's easier to think about how you might manipulate segregation and the quality of schools through policy. If you think about things like family structure or social capital, they might very well be quite important determinants of social mobility. But it's much harder from a policy perspective to think about how you change the structure of families or how you change social capital. I don't think it's impossible. But at this point, I think we have more tools that are readily available to think about how we might go about changing the quality of schools and changing the degree of segregation. And so that's why I think, independent of the strength of these correlations, I mean, if at all, the family structure correlation is probably stronger than the correlations with these two first factors, but in terms of what's manipulable, I think that's a natural place to start. So I'm going to start by talking about segregation, in particular in the context of housing policy, and then I will turn to a set of issues on education policy. The work that I'm going to talk about in this lecture is based primarily on two sets of papers, first with Nathan Hendren and Larry Katz, and then some work on the effects of teachers with John Friedman and Jonah Rokoff. So let's start by talking about segregation and housing policy. So there are many potential policies that we might think about to try to promote integration in cities. So we see that cities like Sacramento, which are more integrated, have much more upward mobility than Atlanta. How might we be able to go about making a place like Atlanta more residentially integrated? So here are a few possibilities. We could think about providing subsidized housing vouchers to allow low-income families to rent apartments in better areas, thereby directly creating more residential integration. We could think about building affordable housing, say giving developers credits to build affordable housing in mixed-income communities, thereby again directly creating more integration. Or we could think about changes in zoning regulations and building restrictions. So for instance, in the Bay Area and some affluent communities in Silicon Valley, you have minimum lot size requirements, like you have to have a yard of at least 1 acre in order to build a house in a city. And what that does is essentially excludes lower income people from those areas. It's basically putting a minimum value on the minimum floor on the value of houses you can build in an area, thereby creating more segregation. So if you didn't have those types of zoning regulations, you'd potentially have more integration, or if you design them differently. Another example is restrictions on building. So often many cities will have limits on the height of buildings or the density at which you can build. And that also, I think, can have important effects on the degree of segregation. So changing those types of policies could potentially also create more integration. So the question I want to ask in this first part of the talk is whether these types of housing policies are effective in increasing social mobility. And I think it's important to keep as a benchmark the idea that you have an alternative, which is rather than, for instance, giving a subsidized housing voucher to a family to move to a better area, you could imagine just giving that family a cash grant of an equivalent amount, right? And standard economic theory, traditional neoclassical economics, would predict that giving families that amount in cash would be strictly better, or at least weakly better, than giving a subsidized housing voucher, because in principle, they could use that cash to do exactly the same thing that they're able to do with housing vouchers. So it's not totally obvious, even if we think that we want to increase integration to raise social mobility, that that necessarily calls for interventions in the housing market. And so I want to come back to this reference point of a cash grant after we see some of the evidence on how these housing policies seem to work. Now, understanding the effects of housing policy, you know, why focus on housing in particular? I think it's a particular interest given the amount governments spend on such policies. So for instance, in the US, we spend about $45 billion per year on affordable housing vouchers. So about $20 billion goes to what are called Section 8 housing vouchers, which give families assistance on the order of $1,000 a month to rent an apartment. We also give tax credits for developers to build affordable housing. And we have various large public housing projects where many families get housing directly provided by the government. Analogously, in many other countries, there's lots of focus on providing housing directly. So more narrowly, the question I want to ask here is whether these particular policies are effective, and how might we be able to better design these policies, you know, holding fixed the $45 billion expenditure that we have, how can we design them more effectively to increase social mobility? And I think actually there are quite a few design changes that can make this money that we're already spending much more effective. So I'm going to start by talking about one specific type of housing policy in detail, which are these housing voucher subsidies. And I'm going to focus on this because it turns out we have a very nice experiment that sheds light on the effects of these types of policies, which was the Moving to Opportunity experiment implemented in the mid-1990s under the Clinton administration. And that experiment, which is one of the most famous experiments in social science, involved about 5,000 families in five large cities in the United States. And the way it worked is that families were randomly assigned to one of three groups. There was an experimental group, which is what we're going to mainly focus on, in which families received housing vouchers that were restricted to be used in low-poverty census tracts. So you got assistance of, say, roughly $1,000 a month, and you could use that to rent an apartment, but it had to be in one of these designated census tracts that was viewed as low-poverty and hence high opportunity in relation to what we were talking about in the last lecture. These places with lower levels of poverty tend to appear to generate better outcomes for kids. The second group was the conventional Section 8 housing voucher group, where people got the same exact vouchers in terms of cash value, but there were no restrictions placed on the vouchers. You could use them anywhere. And importantly, notice that this is a strictly better option, in a sense, relative to the experimental voucher, because you can do exactly what you could do with the experimental voucher if you got the Section 8 voucher. You could go to the same places if you wanted to. And I'm going to come back to think about that comparison and what we learned from that. And then finally, there was a control group that didn't get a voucher and instead was just offered the option of remaining in public housing, which typically was in relatively high poverty census tracts, 50% at the point at which the experiment started. So they basically took a set of families living in these very high poverty public housing projects and randomly assigned them to one of these three groups in order to be able to look at outcomes. So to make this concrete, let me give you an example of what this looked like in the New York City area. So they took a set of families living in the Martin Luther King Towers, which is a very large public housing project in Harlem, a very high poverty, concentrated poverty public housing project. And some of those families that were assigned to the experimental group, a number of them moved to a place called Wakefield in the North Bronx, which is about 10 miles away from Harlem. And the families who were assigned to the Section 8 group, many of them moved to a place called Soundview in the Bronx, which is about 6 miles away from Harlem. And then the control group families, many of them stayed in the Martin Luther King Towers or somewhere nearby. So the question we're asking, basically, is how did the outcomes of the kids who grew up here or here versus in the Martin Luther King Towers, you know, what did things look like for the families that were randomly assigned to these three different places? So there's been a really large body of research by both economists and sociologists over the past 20 years or so studying this experiment. And somewhat disappointingly, it's found very little impact of moving to a better area on economic outcomes such as earnings. So when you look in the data at the earnings of adults who were in the North Bronx versus in the Martin Luther King Towers, you found relatively little difference. And that was viewed, I think, as quite a disappointment for social scientists interested in these issues, because contrary to the hypothesis that people went into this experiment with, that neighborhood really matters, this experimental evidence really didn't seem to support that hypothesis. But critically, prior work has focused primarily on adults and kids who were older at the point of the move. Now, you'll remember from the evidence I was showing you in the last lecture that when you look at the 7 million movers in the observational data, you find that the effects accumulate over time. So there are bigger effects for kids who move at younger ages and smaller effects for kids who move at older ages, because it appears to take time for these effects to accumulate and rub off on children. So that is, there's an exposure effect proportional to the time of exposure. And so after Nathan and I had worked on that first paper, we wanted to think about how our findings fit with the moving to opportunity evidence. You know, we were convinced that there were causal effects of neighborhoods in the quasi-experimental analysis we had done. And so we revisited the MTO experiment, and, you know, we had the hypothesis that maybe in the MTO data you'd find an effect that was similar in terms of exposure. In particular, perhaps you'd find an effect for kids who were younger at the point of the move. And so that's exactly what we set out to do with Larry Katz. We linked the original MTO data to the tax records that I was discussing in the previous lecture to study the long-term impacts of the experiment. After they had stopped following the families, you know, this is more like a 20, 25-year follow-up. So now we can look at the impacts of kids who moved at relatively young ages on their earnings when they're in their mid-20s. And so I'm going to summarize what we find with a series of bar charts. This is a pure experiment, so you can basically compare means across these three groups. And what I'm showing here are what are called treatment on the treated estimates. So the take-up rate of the experimental voucher was not 100%, it was 50%. So we're basically doubling the estimates that we find in terms of differences in average earnings to account for the fact that only half the people who were offered the voucher actually used it to move to a better area. So we're just making an adjustment for imperfect take-up when we show you these means. But essentially, you can think of this as average earnings in this first panel on the left for children below the age of 13. So we're looking at kids who were relatively young at the point of the move, okay, and that's critical. And we're looking at average earnings in the three groups to which people were randomly assigned. The control group in the gray, the Section 8 group, the people who moved to, you know, the mid-Bronx in the blue, and the experimental voucher group in the red, the people who moved to the North Bronx. Okay, and you can see that there are quite substantial differences in average earnings for these kids in their mid-20s. This is a very low-income, very disadvantaged population, so you can see mean earnings in the control group are only $11,000 per year, and this is in, you know, just in the past few years. In the Section 8 group, that goes up to 13,000, And in the experimental voucher group, it's 14,700, so roughly a 30% increase from the mean level of earnings in the control group. So quite a substantial change in percentage terms, larger than many other interventions that we typically think about, like the rate of return to education and so forth. 30% gap is quite large. And that's, statistically significant with a p-value of 0.01. Now, we look at a variety of other outcomes as well. So this here is showing you rates of college attendance, 16.5% in the control group, 18% in the Section 8 group, nearly 22% in the experimental group. So the kids who are growing up in these lower poverty areas are earning substantially more. They're substantially more likely to go to college. We also look at outcomes that are relevant for the next generation of kids. So the children of these children who we were looking at in the previous slide are basically the grandchildren of the parents who were involved in the experiment. And so, you can see that some of these effects are likely to persist across multiple generations. So the way to see that is in this panel here on the left, we're looking at measures of neighborhood quality where the kids are living when they are young adults, when they themselves are likely to be having kids. And so here we're looking at the poverty rate in the zip code in which they live. And you can see that in the control group, it's a 24% poverty share. In the Section 8 group, it's 21.7%. The experimental group, it's down to 20%. So in other words, the kids themselves are living in better neighborhoods as adults, and hence their own kids are going to be growing up in areas with less concentrated poverty. So that initial intervention we did in the 1990s looks like it's going to have persistent effects, not just for this next generation of kids who are earning more, but the following generation as well. Another aspect of that is that these kids are much less likely to become single mothers. So among the women in the experiment, 33% in the control group are single moms, 31% in the Section 8 group, down to 23% in the experimental voucher group. And we talked about in the last lecture how there seems to be a significant association between the fraction of single moms in an area and rates of upward mobility. While I was saying earlier, we don't know how to directly manipulate things like family structure, this kind of intervention of creating more residential integration through a housing voucher appears to have downstream effects on marital, on family structure as well. So perhaps having impacts on the following generation through that additional mechanism also. So all of these impacts are for children who were below the age of 13 at the point of the move. So now let's do the same analysis, looking at the kids who were older, who were teenagers at the point of the move, between the ages of 13 and 18. And here you see a completely different picture. So you look at the control group, mean earnings are nearly 16,000. In the experimental voucher group, if anything, they appear to be slightly lower than in the control group. That difference is not statistically significant, but certainly there's no evidence of a gain like we saw for the kids who moved at younger ages. Similarly, if we look at the fraction of kids who are single moms, that also doesn't look substantially better for the kids in the experimental voucher group. Once again, if anything, it looks slightly worse. Now, these differences on this slide are not statistically significant, but they point in the direction that the kids in the experimental group actually seem to be doing a little bit worse than the kids in the control group. So what might be going on? Why is it that moving to a better area at an older age actually seems to hurt you? One possibility is that there's a disruption effect. So there's some fixed cost of moving to a better neighborhood, and it takes time to recoup the costs of that investment, right? So imagine a model where if you move, you take a fixed, you take a hit in your earnings of, let's say, minus $1,000, and then every extra year of exposure you have to that place, let's say you gain $200 or $300. So what you're going to see if that's the true model is that for kids who move at older ages, they get that minus $1,000 fixed cost, and so they end up losing because, there isn't enough time for that exposure effect to really rub off, that maybe that fixed cost emerges from a disruption in their social network or, it takes time to adjust to the new place, et cetera. But for the kids who move at younger ages, those $200 per year gains, they accumulate such that if you move at a young enough age, there's a significant positive effect from moving. So that type of model could potentially explain why when kids move when they're older, you actually don't see a gain and you might actually see a loss whereas for younger kids, the exposure effects add up and you end up seeing significant gains. So putting this together, in the moving to opportunity data, you can construct a figure that looks somewhat like the one that I showed you in the previous lecture where we used the 7 million movers across areas in the observational data. And you can plot the treatment effects on for the experimental group relative to the control group by the child's age at random assignment. And you can see that you get the same type of declining pattern that I showed you in the previous lecture. Now, this chart, you know, has much wider confidence intervals and is much more imprecise than what we saw in the previous lecture. That's, of course, the advantage of having 7 million observations instead of 4,000 observations here. So that's the power of using the big data set with a quasi-experimental approach relative to running a much smaller experiment. But regardless, the fact that these two things paint this very similar picture, I think, strongly suggests that this seems to be a pretty robust pattern when families move, these exposure effects that accumulate over childhood. Now, when we look at adults, we replicate exactly the findings that Katz and others had documented in prior research, where you see absolutely no evidence of any gains in earnings for adults from being randomized to a better location. And that's consistent with what I was talking about in the previous lecture as well, that it really seems like childhood environment is what's driving these differences across areas. Moving to a better place when you're an adult doesn't do a whole lot for you in terms of economic outcomes. So what do we learn from this reanalysis of the moving to opportunity experiment? First, we see that housing vouchers can be very effective in improving families' long-term outcomes, kids' long-term outcomes, but I think they have to be targeted very carefully. In particular, you can see here that vouchers should be targeted at families with young children. So when we move families with older children, we really don't see much of a gain at all, at least in the context of economic outcomes, and we might be hurting some of them. So to the extent possible, you given limited dollars, actually only 1 in 5 families that are eligible for vouchers in the United States is actually able to get one because there's insufficient funding for the program. You'd need $100 billion of funding to fund all the families that would be eligible each year, and we only have $20 billion. And so in selecting which families to prioritize, given the evidence I showed you, you know, it makes sense to put the people who have the youngest children first in line. Now, unfortunately, it turns out in the U.S. that we do exactly the opposite. There are wait lists such that you sign up for the housing voucher program when you have a kid, and then in many cities it can take 7 or 8 years before you actually get off of that wait list and get to rent an apartment in a better area. And so what ends up happening is often families with very young kids, who I think we'd ideally be targeting, are not the ones who are able to move to better areas, and it ends up only being when their kids are older that they can move, which is exactly backwards, right, in light of the evidence that I was showing you. So that's, I think, a type of very simple policy change, which some cities are actually now considering in the U.S., that given a fixed amount of expenditure could generate much better outcomes. Now, another way in which I think targeting is important is that vouchers should explicitly encourage families to move to affordable, high-opportunity areas. So the reason I say this is, you know, you might think, let's just give people an unrestricted voucher and let them move wherever they want, and we're going to get, you know, really good outcomes. That's what the standard economic model would suggest, at least. But what you see in the MTO data is that the unrestricted Section 8 vouchers, those were the middle bars that I was showing you, they actually produce smaller gains, even though families could, in principle, have made exactly the same choices, right? There's no reason that the people who chose to move to the mid-Bronx couldn't have moved to the North Bronx. They got exactly the same money. But for whatever reason, they chose not to make the same decision, you know, when they weren't restricted to moving to a lower poverty census tract. And what you see is that, as a result, their kids don't gain nearly as much. So putting in that restriction that they had to move to the low-poverty census tract actually seems to really meaningfully affect their children's long-term outcomes without particularly having any significant effects on the adults' earnings. The adults' earnings are basically the same if they get the Section 8 voucher or in the control group or in the experimental group. Now, moreover, other research by Brian Jacob and colleagues shows that low-income families rarely use cash transfers to move to better neighborhoods. So if you have a policy that basically gives a low-income family a cash grant of an equivalent amount to a housing voucher, they don't in practice use it to move to a neighborhood like the North Bronx where their kids would do much better. They spend that money on other things. And you don't end up finding any impact, significant impact on children's long-term outcomes. So putting these results together, these findings basically suggest that the standard neoclassical view that giving people the most choice possible by just giving them cash doesn't really seem to generate the best outcomes, right? Contradicting the idea that people optimize effectively from the perspective of maximizing their children's long-term welfare. Now, of course, people might have other objectives in mind. Maybe their, utility function doesn't put a lot of weight on their children's long-term success, or maybe they prioritize other factors in their life, like living near their current friends or other amenities, et cetera. So it's not necessarily the case that you have a violation of rationality here. But regardless, if from a policy perspective, we want to increase social mobility and improve the outcomes of children from low-income families, this suggests that a very unrestricted policy where you just give people cash or give people these generic housing vouchers that don't try to direct them to particular areas is not going to be nearly as effective as if we have more targeted housing vouchers. Now, so all of that, I think suggests that targeted housing vouchers designed properly can in principle be pretty effective in improving outcomes for disadvantaged youth. But there are a number of potential concerns that people often have in the context of such policies. The first is costs. So you might think that areas that offer better opportunity tend to be more expensive. And so, if we want to send a lot of people to the North Bronx or to places like that, isn't it going to be really costly for the government to implement such a program? So the first point I want to make in this context is that there are many opportunity bargains that you can find, it appears in the data. That is, there are many places you can find that have relatively low rents, but nevertheless offer quite good opportunities for kids. And so to illustrate that, I'm going to show you some preliminary data from work we're doing now, where previously in the last lecture I showed you measures of opportunity at the broad metro area level and the county level. What we're working on in the moment is geocoding the entire U.S. population so that we can construct these measures of opportunity at the census tract and zip code level, at much finer levels of geography, so that you can really get a sense of neighborhoods within a city. And so what we're doing here is that analysis in the New York City area, constructing measures of opportunity by zip code in New York using the same methodology that I described in the last lecture, exploiting people who move across areas to identify the causal effects of each place on earnings. And so on the y-axis here, you can think of this as an opportunity index. What's the causal effect of growing up in a given place relative to the average place in America? So for example, the plus 20 here means if you grow up in an area like that, you're going to have 20% higher earnings than if you grow up in the average place. And then the minus 30 down here, like you see the Martin Luther King Towers, for example, we estimate you'd have 20% lower earnings than the average place in America if you grew up there from birth. Okay, so those are our measures of opportunity, and we're plotting them against average monthly rents in the zip code, in each of these zip codes. And these rents, by the way, are measured in 2000, so prior to the really sharp run-up in prices in some of these places in New York. And so you can see there's a upward sloping relationship between opportunity and rent, as you might expect, right? So places that are more expensive tend to also offer better opportunity, which I think is intuitive. People bid up prices in places that seem good for their kids. And so to take one example, Park Slope in New York, which is where the mayor of New York used to live, is an expensive way to buy opportunity. It's the monthly rent was roughly $2,000 in 2000, and Park Slope is near the top in terms of impacts on kids' outcomes. Now, importantly, though, you can go to a place like Rockaway Park or East Midwood, which offers basically the same level of opportunity by our estimates as Park Slope, at basically half the rent. And so these kinds of places up here are what we're calling opportunity bargains. And we think what we should be trying to do with housing voucher policy is send families to these sorts of places that would be affordable for low-income families once they get housing voucher assistance and would still generate very good outcomes for their kids. And so we're working with the Housing and Urban Development Agency and a number of public housing authorities around the U.S. to design a set of experimental interventions to figure out how we can get more families to move to precisely these areas. So I think the cost consideration, while potentially an important one, is one that can be overcome when we have these sorts of data. We can identify these types of bargains, and we can, in a cost-effective way, help families move to neighborhoods that they can afford where their kids will do much better. A second important point in this context is that the vouchers can actually end up saving taxpayers' money in the long run relative to public housing projects. And that's because when these kids have higher earnings themselves, they end up paying more income taxes back to the government, just mechanically, because when you have higher earnings, you're obviously going to pay higher taxes. And so this chart here is showing you annual income tax revenue from kids, once they're adults, from kids in the control group, Section 8 group, and the experimental voucher group. And you can see that each year we're collecting about $400 extra in tax revenue from the kids who were assigned to the experimental voucher group relative to the control group. And so adding that up over kids' lifetimes, we estimate that just the added tax revenue is going to more than offset the incremental cost of providing them these vouchers to move out of the public housing projects. And so it's, even if we have to move families to relatively, expensive areas, it's not clear that in a long-run sense that that's going to cost the government a lot of money, because you're going to end up making quite a bit of money just from the kids' higher earnings themselves in terms of future taxes. A second prominent concern with this type of policy is negative spillovers. So politically, there's a lot of resistance to policies like Section 8 housing vouchers and integration more generally from more affluent people, because they're worried that bringing in more low-income people into a neighborhood might end up hurting the rich, right? So you might worry, we've seen, that low-income families do better when they live in these mixed-income areas, but does that come at the expense of the higher-income kids doing worse? Does it look like sort of a zero-sum game? Are there negative peer effects on the rich? So that's, a difficult question to answer experimentally. What I can say here is that empirically what we find is that more integrated neighborhoods, when we look at the outcomes of kids in higher income families, they don't seem any worse. More integrated neighborhoods do not have worse outcomes for the rich. And you can see that in this chart that I showed in the last lecture, where we compared intergenerational mobility in Salt Lake City and Charlotte. And, Salt Lake City is a more integrated city with more social capital, more interaction between the poor and the rich. Charlotte is a very segregated city. And what we focused on in the last lecture is that outcomes for low-income kids in Charlotte look much worse at the bottom end of the income distribution than outcomes for low-income kids growing up in Salt Lake City. But importantly now, here, if we focus on the kids at the high end of the income distribution, we see that there's no evidence that the kids growing up in high-income families in Salt Lake City are doing any better or any worse than the kids in high-income families in Charlotte, right? Their mean outcomes look basically the same. And that's a generic finding across all cities. We find no systematic association between the degree of segregation and outcomes for kids in high-income families. So in practice, while you might worry about these negative spillovers, and it's possible they might exist despite the evidence that I'm showing you, there's no smoking gun evidence in the data that the rich tend to do worse in more integrated cities, which I think from a political perspective for supporting these policies is incredibly important. The third concern is limit to scalability, that there are going to be general equilibrium effects if we move lots of people. So obviously, if we tried to move everyone in Harlem to the Bronx, did the moving to opportunity experiment at full scale, I would be surprised if you had the same effects that I was showing you here, right, when you moved individual kids. It's presumably the set of people you're living around that's generating these different outcomes, and if you move enormous numbers of people, then that whole equilibrium is going to change. And that, I think, is ultimately the reason that you need to look beyond housing voucher policies as a way that you're going to, as a way to increase integration. You ultimately need to turn to policies that are going to increase integration in other ways, right, without just directly appealing to moving low-income families. So I think we know less on other policy options. We certainly don't have evidence that's as sharp as what we have from the MTO experiment. But let me just mention here, you know, some ideas of things that we could potentially study in more detail, or things we could potentially do to try to increase integration in other ways. So one thing you can do, which we do in practice and we need to evaluate the effectiveness of, is providing tax credits to encourage developers to build affordable properties in higher income neighborhoods. So at the moment in the U.S., we spend about $6 billion a year on a program called the Low Income Housing Tax Credit, which gives developers tax credits to build housing that'll be affordable to lower income people. Now, the unfortunate thing about that program is, again, I think it's designed in a way that is not particularly effective. Developers get larger credits if they build this affordable housing in very high poverty areas. Now, if you think about what that does, that basically increases segregation because it increases the amount of low-income people living in places of concentrated poverty, doing exactly the opposite of, I think, what we should be trying to achieve, which is creating more integration. So I think that system should be changed so we offer larger tax credits for building affordable housing in more mixed-income areas rather than high-poverty areas. But I think that's one plausible approach. Another approach that you might think about is, instead of trying to move the low-income families, what if we try to move the high-income families into areas where low-income people live, thereby creating more integration? Now, this, of course, both in many U.S. cities and here in London, is already happening, basically, due to market forces, as we have gentrification, with higher-income people moving into the city centers and so forth. Now, often what happens when you have gentrification is low-income people get completely pushed out. And so I think thinking about how you can retain housing options for low- and middle-income families in these areas as cities gentrify is another natural way in which you might increase integration. A third approach is improved urban planning. For instance, changes in zoning regulations of the type that I was describing initially, changes in public transportation, which might change where people want to live. Recently in Silicon Valley, people are talking a lot about driverless cars as potentially changing where people are going to want to live, and maybe that'll have some effect on residential integration. So I think thinking intelligently about this set of issues can also be quite valuable. And then the fourth approach is investing in local public infrastructure, right? So what's one way in which you might be able to draw more high-income people into neighborhoods where lower and middle-income people currently live is, say, improving the schools in an area. Often high-income people want to live in completely separate areas because there are better public schools in those places. And that, you know, is something in principle we can fix. And so that is a segue to the next set of issues I want to talk about, schools in particular, focusing on education policies and thinking directly about improving schools as a way to improve upward mobility, independent of potential effects on residential segregation. So, you know, many people, it's not news that improving school quality could be a good way to think about improving children's long-term outcomes and intergenerational mobility. But simply spending more on schools, I think, might not be enough. Often when we think about a problem like this, as economists, our first instinct is to think about expenditure on a public good. And one way you can see that that might not be enough is that the U.S. actually spends more than most other developed countries on education, on primary education per capita. Yet it has significantly worse outcomes. So places like Finland and Sweden have much better educational outcomes than the U.S., but spend much less money on primary schools. So that view, put forth by Rick Hanushek and a number of others, suggests that we need to really understand the production function, the education production function, understand which educational inputs matter most for children's long-term success. It's not just about the dollars. It's about understanding things like the effects of class size, teachers, resources, and so forth, and figuring out how we can do better in terms of allocating our dollars to these particular inputs to generate better outcomes. Now, there's a really vast literature in education on all of these issues. And increasingly, I think the frontier of that literature is looking not just at the impacts of class size and teachers on short-term outcomes like test scores, but also on longer-term outcomes like earnings many, many years later, which we're now able to do thanks to these newly available large panel data sets. So I'm going to focus here on one example from our group's research looking at the long-term impacts of teachers that's illustrative of the broader set of findings that are being generated in this literature. So what we're going to do is use big data to study teachers' impacts by taking information for all kids who went to New York City public schools between 1989 and 2009. So that's 2.5 million children who wrote 18 million tests over that 20-year period. And we're going to link that data to the federal income tax returns that I've been showing you results from in the past few studies. So by linking those two data sets, we're able to ask a question like, how does the quality of your third grade teacher affect how much you're earning when you're, say, 25 or 30 years old? How does it affect which college you attend? How does it affect whether you have a teenage birth or not? So we can look at the impacts of childhood education on outcomes in adulthood. Now, in order to answer that question, the first thing we need to do is have a measure of teacher quality that we're going to examine, right? So if I want to show you that teacher quality has really significant impacts on long-term outcomes, I need to have some metric for measuring the quality of teachers. The metric we're going to use here are test score-based value-added metrics. So we focus on this partly because we have good data to construct these measures and partly because they're very important in the context of the current policy debate in the U.S. and many other countries where people are asking whether evaluating teachers' impacts based on their effects on students' test scores is a good way to assess teacher quality. Okay? So the measures we're going to use are called teacher value-added measures. Value-added measures at their core, while there's some fairly complicated statistical issues in the background, at their core, it's really a very simple concept. We ask how much does a teacher raise his or her students' test scores on average. So for example, if I'm a third grade teacher, we'd calculate my value added by taking my students' test scores on average at the end of third grade minus their test scores on average at the beginning of third grade or at the end of second grade. And if that number was very positive, we'd say I'm a high value added teacher. And if, unfortunately, it was very negative, we'd say I'm a low value added teacher, right? So that's basically what the concept of teacher value added is. Now, we want to assess whether teacher value added has significant causal effects on children's learning and on their long-term success, on their earnings, college attendance rates, and so forth. Now, it's useful in these kinds of situations, I think, to step back and ask, what is the ideal experiment that you would run in order to answer that question, identify that causal effect? So the ideal experiment in this context, if you could run any experiment you wanted, would be to take a set of teachers in a given school and rate them on their value added based on historical data, based on data for students they taught previously. So, you know, take previous years of data and compute each teacher's value added based on the method that I showed you here. And then what you do is take a new batch of students and tell their parents, look, we want to answer this really important question of whether teacher quality matters for kids' long-term outcomes. So we're going to randomly assign some of your kids to teachers we've identified as being high value added, and we'll randomly assign some of your kids to teachers we've identified as being low value added, and let's see how they do in about 20 years. So you can imagine running that experiment in practice is very difficult. That's the challenge we face in answering a lot of these questions. But what I'm going to show you here is we can basically approximate an experiment that looks like that with these large data sets that we now have. So what we're going to exploit is the fact that there's a lot of turnover in schools, in teachers within a school. Lots of teachers come in and leave or switch grades, go on maternity leave, and so forth. And that effectively creates variation that looks like the experiment that I just described to you. So again, rather than going into the econometric details, I'm just going to illustrate what we find with a simple example that captures the key idea. So what we're going to do is examine a given school over time. So take a given school in New York City, and we're going to look at the average test scores of kids in fourth grade. We're going to look at fourth graders who get to the school in different years, so in 1993, 1994, 1995, and so on. So these are fourth graders in different birth cohorts, right? They're arriving in fourth grade in different calendar years. And so we're going to start by just looking at the evolution of test scores in the school over time. And you could see that, you know, across the years, 93, 94, 95, test scores are kind of bouncing around the median at the 50th percentile on average. And so, by the way, I'm describing this to you in the context of one specific school, but we're averaging over thousands of such events in our data to do this essentially event study analysis. So what happens in this school is that at the end of the 1995 school year, there's a new teacher who comes in who's estimated to be in the top 5% of the value-added distribution based on historical data. And so what happens to test scores when that new teacher comes in? Test scores immediately jump up, and they continue to stay high as that teacher continues to teach subsequent cohorts of kids. Okay? So that looks like there's a, you know, causal treatment effect of this high value-added teacher entering on the amount that students are learning as measured by standardized tests. Now, naturally, in a setting like this, you have a treatment group where something changed. You also want to have a control group to make sure that nothing else changed at the same time, like the school getting better for some other reason that might be contaminating this analysis, right? And so a very natural control group in this context is to look at test scores at the end of third grade, the idea being that if the better teacher came in fourth grade, she couldn't possibly have had a causal effect on outcomes in the previous grade, right? And so, in fact, when you plot test scores in third grade, you see that they're totally flat around the point that the high-quality teacher enters in fourth grade. So this type of evidence and other related findings that I'm not going to describe here basically lead us to conclude that value added is a pretty good measure of the causal effects of teachers on student achievement as measured by standardized tests. So in this example here, I'm focusing on the top end of the distribution, high quality teachers in the top 5% of the distribution, but this works totally symmetrically in the opposite direction as well. So if you have this teacher here who doesn't want to be there and is in the bottom 5% of the value added distribution, he immediately pulls down test scores relative to the prior grade when he comes in, right? So this works completely symmetrically across the distribution. So that evidence shows you that teachers matter for the amount students learn as measured by standardized tests. But of course, what we ultimately care about is the impact of teachers on students' long-term outcomes. That's what's relevant in terms of thinking about education policy. That's what's relevant for thinking about social mobility. So we do an analogous analysis now using long-term outcomes instead of the test scores. And so I'm going to skip the details of that in the interest of time and just summarize it with this chart here, which illustrates the value of improving teacher quality with a hypothetical policy exercise. So let's say we take the bell curve of teacher value added, and we identify the teachers who are in the bottom 5% of the distribution in terms of value added. And suppose we implemented a policy where we took those bottom 5% of teachers and either replaced them with teachers of average quality by hiring new teachers, which is a feasible policy in principle, or we give them some training that brings them up to the average level of quality. Okay? What impact would that have? Based on the estimates using the research design of teachers switching in and out that I just showed you, looking at long-term impacts, we estimate that this simple change would increase the lifetime earnings of the average child in the U.S. by $50,000. So having a teacher who's at the average level of value added in the New York City school district instead of in the bottom 5% for a single grade will increase your lifetime earnings by $50,000, which translates to a gain of $1.4 million per classroom of 28 students, which is the average class size in New York City. Or if you want to view this as an investment and discount it back to present value at the point at which the intervention is occurring, roughly age 10 or so, that's worth about $250,000 in present value, discounting at a 5% interest rate. So relative to teachers' salaries and relative to, you know, just the magnitudes that we think about in terms of improving children's outcomes, you can see that a simple intervention like improving the quality of teachers in a single grade can have quite substantial impacts on children's long-term outcomes. And that is an example, more broadly, of how improving the quality of elementary education can be, I think, a key policy tool to increasing upward mobility. Now, teacher quality, based on various studies that have now been done, I think appears to be particularly important. So there are many ingredients that go into a good education. I think teacher quality is critical. There's some evidence that having smaller classes is also valuable. But I would say if I were to pick between the two, I would put emphasis on teacher quality rather than class size in light of the evidence we have. So having a high-quality teacher teach a slightly larger group of students is probably better than hiring a new teacher who's of average or below average quality just to get smaller class sizes. And this is an important debate because you can structure schools in different ways given the limited resources you have. Another important point to note is when we do the type of analysis I was showing you here, I gave you the example of fourth grade, but you can do the same analysis in fifth grade, sixth grade, et cetera, et cetera. And you find that better teachers have roughly the same effect on long-term outcomes in all the grades we're able to study, K through 8. We haven't done an analysis of high school yet. And so, you know, having a teacher at the average instead of in the bottom 5% in third grade is just as valuable as having that kind of better teacher in eighth grade, which is consistent with the idea that I was showing you in the previous lecture, that every extra year you're exposed to a better environment in terms of neighborhood environment is worth roughly the same amount in terms of long-term impacts, both early in childhood and later in childhood. So you see the same kind of thing in the context of educational environment, in the context of the quality of teachers in particular. There's no critical age after which education somehow becomes less important. So what does this mean in terms of policy? I think what we learn from this is that it's critical to attract and retain top talent in teaching in primary school. And the way I think about, you know, how you might go about doing that is sort of a superstar model, which is very different from the model we currently have in the U.S., where teaching is often not attracting the most talented people. It's not the profession that the most successful students in our colleges aspire to go into. And I think you want to structure it so that the very best people want to go into teaching because of the tremendous externalities they basically have on a large population. And you want to keep those teachers in the school system. So a major problem in many public schools is that highly effective teachers end up wanting to leave because they can make a lot more money in some other profession where they'll also be quite good. So I think higher salaries can potentially help, and in particular trying to pay higher salaries to these very highly effective teachers, which currently is not possible under U.S. regulations in most school districts where pay is purely a function of experience and not related to performance in any way. So I think some reform of salaries could help, but ultimately my sense is changing the professional status of the teaching profession is quite important. So in a place like Finland, for example, you hear that kids who are at the top of their class, their goal is to become a teacher, and that's certainly not the case, I think, in many other countries that have weaker educational systems. One way in which you might be able to, one example of a program that I think is having quite a bit of effect is the Teach First program here, or Teach for America program in the United States, which is quite successful, actually, in getting very talented kids into the classroom. But the problem is that those teachers tend not to stay. A lot of people will do that program for 2 years and then end up leaving, and that's not a great arrangement because what you see in the data is that teachers tend to become much more effective exactly after they've spent a couple of years in the classroom. So you really want to have people staying longer than that very short period. So just for the students here, I want to show that, you know, this kind of work actually, you know, ultimately has some impact on policy. So in light of the education work, you can see here that the president of the State of the Union address says, we know a good teacher can increase the lifetime income of a classroom by over $250,000. Every person in this chamber can point to a teacher who's changed the trajectory of their lives. And then similarly, Michael Bloomberg talks about how teachers are really important. And so there are a number of school districts now around the U.S. trying to think carefully about how you might be able to implement reforms to basically have more flexibility to retain the most effective teachers in the classroom. And you know, that goes along with a number of other changes in U.S. educational systems based on this and a variety of other research that people have done. So I think, you know, these kinds of data can really have tangible impacts on policy and ultimately on people's lives. So I'm going to wrap up today by just stepping back and asking whether increasing social mobility, which I've just taken, you know, by assumption as the goal we want to achieve, and I've talked in this lecture about policies that might help us achieve that, I want to ask whether, you know, that actually makes sense as a goal. We've assumed so far that our objective should be to increase social mobility, but it's not totally clear that that should be our ultimate objective, right? So policies that increase mobility might not be desirable from an efficiency perspective, for example. So as I mentioned briefly in the previous lecture, if you take, you know, an extreme example, suppose we just randomly allocated college seats, like who got into LSE. That would be a way to maximize social mobility, actually, because you would, you know, your prospects of doing well would be independent of your family background, basically, by design. But I think most of us would think that's probably not a very good policy because it violates other principles that we have, like meritocracy. And it would also likely reduce total economic output and growth because we have the wrong people matched to the wrong environments, essentially, or the wrong jobs, the wrong colleges. So in tomorrow's lecture, what I want to do is assess the trade-off between mobility and growth in light of these issues and think about whether increasing social mobility is really a desirable goal, focusing in particular on innovation as a driver for growth. And I'm going to argue that at least in certain contexts, there's probably not a trade-off between greater mobility and efficiency, and in particular in the context of innovation. So I'll stop there for today.
Thank you very much, Raj. So I think what we'll do is if people can raise their hands who'd like to ask a question, and there's mics going around. So there's one gentleman in the center here.
Hello, my name's Duncan Exley. I'm presently writing on social mobility, so this is extremely valuable. A couple of things that I thought immediately raised as potential niggles with this. One of which is that the high opportunity bargain areas. In recent years, there's been an awful lot of new data available and available to the public. For instance, school league tables, Acorn data in the UK. So I was wondering whether there's a risk that those bargains will cease to exist because privileged people will spot the bargains and buy them themselves. But also on the matter of there being more taxes paid by people who have achieved social mobility and about whether that is... whether that is the effect of that is knocked out by those people out-competing other people who will therefore be paying less taxes.
Yeah, thanks. Both very good questions. So will the opportunity bargains cease to exist? So I think your intuition is exactly right, that as you make information more available, people take advantage of it. So a good example of that is a nice paper by Justine Hastings and Doug Steger, where they look exactly at these school league tables, actually, as you said. They look at information in North Carolina that disclosed data on the quality of schools as measured by students' test score performance. And they have this very nice result where they show that kids from high-income families, high-income parents basically took advantage of that information to send their kids to what appear to be better schools. And lower-income families were much less likely to use that information. So they conducted an experiment where they provided this information in the form of simple brochures to lower-income families and showed that that affected their choices significantly. So that shows that people do act on this type of information. And you're right that you know, what I think is salient to most people are things like the quality of schools. And so house prices tend to be very high in places with good schools, and that's one way to buy opportunity that, you know, is expensive. One way to think about what we're doing with the opportunity bargains is basically identifying places that seem relatively good despite not necessarily having outstanding schools that you know about. So you're right that once you make this information publicly available, which is what we intend to do, so basically present the information on opportunity by census tract in each area, that could potentially down the road lead to a bidding up of house prices in those places, and hence they no longer become bargains. There's a question of how much uptake would be needed of this information to have that kind of equilibrium effect on prices. I think in a way you'd have to be quite successful with this intervention for that effect to actually occur. So, you know, certainly I think I take your question as saying what is an opportunity bargain now may not forever remain an opportunity bargain. That's certainly true. And so I think paying attention to these data over time will be valuable, and figuring out how much voucher assistance you need to give a low-income family so that they can buy in these places will be important. I think it's also important to note that a lot of expensive places are not necessarily good just because they provide better opportunity, because people often want to bid up house prices in certain areas because they are convenient in terms of location, or it's just viewed as a very fancy area for reasons that have nothing to do with kids' outcomes. And the point I want, one related point is that you don't want to be sending low-income families to those places because you sort of, you know, you're not getting optimal outcomes. Your second point on tax revenue, you're right. So that we were basically making the assumption that the added tax revenue from the one child doesn't come at the expense of other kids. And that touches upon issues in this last slide, basically. So does one person's gain come at someone else's expense? Or is that one child's gain, you know, contributing to total GDP and just raising total output and total tax revenue? That's exactly the kind of issue that I think, you know, the answer is not totally clear, and I will talk a little bit about that in the next lecture.
Okay, another gentleman at the back.
Hello there, thank you for your lecture. My name's Jack Winterton, I'm a graduate of LSE. I have two questions, really. My first, you mentioned towards the end of the first part of your lecture that one of the options for an area that's gentrifying is to retain social housing for low and middle income families. It tends to be that wealthy people would like to live in areas that might be in the same locality but sort of street by street level. They'd prefer to be segregated. Can you sort of comment on how you have got a social mix here but then you have got segregation sort of on a street by street level?
And yeah.
The second question is how do you think that sort of moving people out of a community like Harlem is, and moving to the Bronx, is actually affecting, or can you comment on sort of the effects that this has on Harlem itself?
Yeah, those are good questions that I think we don't have a great deal of evidence on yet. So the segregation by street, you're right that you see people self-segregate at a very local level. And I think in order to understand whether that matters or not, we need to have a better handle on what level, the level at which segregation matters, right? So is this about being separated from other people in the schools you attend, or, you know, who you see at the playground, or is it literally about integration within a given building? And my intuition would be that some of both matters. It's basically about what generates interaction. So I would think even if you have some degree of segregation, you know, street by street, but people are still interacting in some way in a given community, you'll get some of the benefits, maybe not all of the benefits that we're talking about here, but that remains to be seen. I think we need further evidence on those issues. On the second question, what happens to the community when people move out? Again, we don't know much yet. I think certainly it'd be surprising if it's a good thing that you know, have people moving out. Probably the people who are more motivated to make that move would have been a good influence on the people who were there previously. That's why I would think it's important to complement any moving to opportunity type of strategy with place-based investments so that you try to improve the quality of schools in Harlem, for example, with the Harlem Children's Zone, which is a great example of that, both trying to revitalize the community while also giving the families that want to have options to move elsewhere the ability to do so.
lady up.
Hi, my name's Ellie. I work for an NGO that focuses on campaigning and advocacy around social inequality. I caveat this with apologising if this question is slightly out of your remit, but we're very lucky to have policy recommendations that are informed by such strong evidence from people like yourself. But we also know that in hostile political climates where austerity prevails, and under Conservative governments, often governments don't care about these kind of policy recommendations. They're telling them things they don't want to do and they don't want to know. So I'd be interested to know whether you've got any examples of strong advocacy based on these kinds of policy recommendations in kind of, you know, in times of austerity that have been successful, or any tips for us who do advocacy work on these kinds of policy recommendations as to how we bring about successful advocacy when governments don't really want to hear what we've got to say?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think in times of austerity, it makes sense to focus on policies that don't require spending vastly more amounts of money. So that's why I was trying to give some examples of cases where you could reform existing programs to make them more impactful without actually spending any additional dollars. So you'll notice a number of the recommendations in the context of housing voucher policy did not involve just increase the amount of money we're giving low-income families, because that actually, in a way, if you know a policy is effective, scaling it up would be the simple way to try to have more of an impact, but it's a very expensive way and a very politically intractable way to move forward. The example I was giving there, for instance, is allocating the money towards families with younger kids. We're going to get more return on our dollars. With the teachers, not necessarily increasing the total salary bill, but rather allocating salaries differently so that we can retain these high value-added teachers in the school system. So I think there are lots of cases, actually, given the amount of expenditure in government programs, where with better evidence we can figure out how to stretch each dollar much more. And I've found people are much more interested in listening to you if you have that kind of recommendation, as you might expect.
There's a question. Yes. Two questions.
Thank you. I just want to ask, you're moving to opportunity evidence. Wasn't so positive about the effects on teenagers, whereas your quasi-experimental evidence was. And I just wondered, how could you reconcile that? What do you think is going on?
Yeah, excellent question. So we think those two pieces of evidence are actually quite consistent. The reason is the following. So in the moving to opportunity data, we're comparing people who move to people who did not move, right? In the quasi-experimental analysis, we're taking a set of people, all of whom moved, and comparing people who moved to better areas with people who moved to worse areas. So that's a crucial distinction, that everyone is moving in the quasi-experimental study, whereas in moving to opportunity, only the treatment group is moving. Because think about the explanation I was giving where there's a fixed cost of just moving to a different place because you get uprooted from your original friends and so forth. Everyone is paying that fixed cost in the quasi-experimental study because they're all movers, and so it's getting netted out in our analysis there. Whereas in MTO, we're comparing movers to non-movers, and so you're including that fixed cost. So I think the two pieces of evidence are perfectly consistent with each other, but what that shows you is from the quasi-experimental analysis, all you can conclude from that is if you're going to move, moving to a better area helps your kids more than moving to a worse area at any age. But that doesn't necessarily tell you that moving is better than not moving. That's what the MTO evidence says. You know, at older ages, the fixed cost is high enough that you might not want to move even if you're in a relatively bad area. So I hope that clarifies it.
Tim Loynig, I work for the UK Government Department for Education and I teach here at LSE. We do a lot of the things that you've recommended already. So we fund our schools in poorer areas about twice as much as schools in richer areas. We mandate that school principals use performance-related pay in assessing teachers' pay each year. We require housing developers to provide social housing every time they put up a new development. If you're poor and you have a child, you automatically get more housing support, and you can take that housing support anywhere in the country, and if you take it to a more expensive area, it generally goes up in value. And yet, as you said yesterday, social mobility is not a lot higher here than in the US, which makes me think that your list of things here might be a good start. They might get you to English levels, but I'm not sure they're a recipe for Canada. And if so, what do you think the next stages would be?
Yeah, great question. I mean... There are a number of factors that play in these cross-country comparisons, right? So while the UK has, you know, appears to what I would consider good policies in a number of those dimensions, there might be a variety of other areas in which the economy is less dynamic or, you know, offers less opportunity for upward mobility for other reasons. So it's hard to conclude simply from that comparison that the impact is only going to be a small gain in mobility. I do think, coming back to that list of five factors initially, you know, we picked these two partly out of practicality to focus on, but I think some of those other factors are really probably very important, like social capital, the stability of families, and so forth. And figuring out ways to make an impact there, if we could figure out how to increase social capital and connectedness in communities, that could potentially have really large effects. In fact, you see stronger correlations with those types of factors, actually, than with things like the quality of schools and segregation. The challenge is, you know, what do you do in that context from a policy perspective? And I think we need creative ideas to think about how to investigate that. One example of how we're trying to think a little bit along that dimension is we're starting a project with my colleague Matt Jackson at Stanford using Facebook data to study the role of networks in mobility. And we think networks might give us a better handle on issues of social capital and peer interaction and role model effects. I think a lot of what might be going on here is changing people's aspirations, something that, you know, these policies could potentially change, but maybe you can change that in a more direct way by changing kids' role models or who they're connected to. And so we're hoping to study that more directly using this network data going forward.
There was a question at the back.
Hi, Professor. My name is Rochen Liu, a graduate student from the Social Policy Department. And I think the number of accommodation in a district is so limited. So if the authority provide vouchers to the low-income families to move into a richer area, it will eventually increase the demand and the rent cost there. So then the families which earn the least will have to move out of these areas and find a cheaper accommodation in some other areas. Compared to their richer neighbors, these moving out families are also disadvantaged and vulnerable groups. So substantially, these endeavors promoting the social mobility are benefiting low-income families by sacrificing the interest of middle class rather than upper class, who should take responsibilities of the loss of these families, the middle class families.
So that's a very good question. There are going to be cascading effects. You know, when you move a low-income family into a middle-income area, that middle-class family that was living there presumably has to move somewhere else. It's possible that the family in the middle class would end up moving to a slightly higher-income area, or move somewhere else. So let me say a couple of things on this. So first of all, it comes back to the point that there are limits to the scalability of any such policies of encouraging families to move. The kinds of equilibrium price effects that you're describing, if you were to move a small number of families, so currently in the U.S., about 2 million families get vouchers. They're scattered throughout the country, you know, in many different parts of each metro area. My sense is that's not big enough to really have an enormous effect on equilibrium prices. And so if you do this at a relatively small scale, which is what I think is plausible, and have it in a decentralized manner so families are moving to many different places, I think you'd mitigate the extent to which you're greatly driving up prices and displacing other people. Now, that said, in many places, for instance, in the Bay Area, the real constraint is on the supply side. So in the Bay Area over the past 5 years or so, there have been 300,000 new jobs added, but only 30,000 new houses built. And so in that kind of environment where you have an incredibly tight supply constraint and very high prices, just giving people vouchers is sort of like a game of musical chairs, right? There are not enough houses. So some people get to move to a better place, but exactly as you said, somebody else gets displaced and so forth. So the voucher solution only makes sense if you have adequate supply and you don't have the types of restrictions we currently have in the Bay Area that are basically preventing builders from building taller buildings or building with greater density and so forth. So I think one needs to think about both supply and the demand side that I was focusing on here.
The gentleman at the back.
On the educational side, you focused on the performance of the individual teacher. I wonder if you could comment on how you see, if you've done any studies on this or whether any studies have been done at all, on the role of the actual management in the school. I'm particularly thinking of the head teacher setting the general standards across the school and the general culture of the school.
Yeah. I think that's extremely important. The principals could play a really important role here. We don't have a great deal of evidence yet on principals' effectiveness directly on long-term outcomes, but there are some nice studies which show how principals are very effective in identifying high-quality teachers, for example. So you actually don't even need to use this data, the statistical method of calculating value added. Another approach to rating the quality of teachers is just based on principals' observations, and they turn out to be very highly correlated with these data-based value-added measures, showing you that the head of the school actually has quite a bit of power to influence, to at least identify who the better teachers are and more broadly probably how to design a good school. But I would note that the ability of the principal to act on that information is greatly constrained by policy. So in the U.S., even if a principal knows that one teacher is much more effective than another teacher, there's essentially no capacity to make sure you keep the one teacher and let go of the other teacher. So in many districts, you have what's called a last-in, first-out layoff policy. So in a recession, the policy is that you must lay off the most recently hired teacher, regardless of merit. And so you see cases where teachers simultaneously receive an award for being one of the best teachers in the school district, while at the same time being laid off, because there's absolutely no scope for discretion. So I think head teachers can matter, but they need to have discretion.
Gentleman in the middle here.
Yes, thanks. Staying with that for a moment, I can never understand why people in these in American urban areas, working class families, really struggled and to pay the fees to send their kids to what was called here faith schools, Catholic schools. But I think you've just answered it, isn't that the public schools, there is a power, and of course the people in right of center blame it on the teachers' union, that there is, unlike here with the academies, there's not so much autonomy provided, given over to the headmasters to set a new agenda, as it were. And so it's really hard to turn a school around. But my question would be, what metrics are used in the urban schools, particularly using New York as an example, to measure these, shall we say, the success or the accomplishments of a school? Is it how many people graduate and go on to universities?
So people are using a variety of metrics, one of which, probably the most prominent of which, are these test scores that I was using here. So people take standardized tests at each grade level in the U.S., and often a school's quality is assessed by progress on those standardized tests, basically, so value-added measures constructed at the school level. But you can also look at things like high school dropout rates, rates of attending college attendance, and so forth. One needs to be careful in constructing these measures, because if you don't try to isolate the value added of the school, you can end up just picking up which schools happen to have a better population. So for instance, if you just look at dropout rates directly, you might find that dropout rates are very low in some school districts with a lot of affluent families or a lot of highly educated families, but that might be because you have a different mix of families rather than because the school is actually very good, right? So I think the key challenge in assessing the quality of schools is to identify the value added as opposed to just differences across areas, and the test scores give you one way to measure progress systematically over time.
The question, the lady in the... Sorry.
What happens to the kids in Harlem, so that we move some of the kids out to families out to their neighbors. And you know, know the UK is going to do a big debate around what this means, at the heart of which is does social mobility for some justify reduction of outcomes for the masses? And you spoke about targeting the policies of vouchers and selected to use so that you avoid kind of reducing the equilibrium. And I wondered if there are studies that show exactly how you should be targeting those policies to avoid it destabilizing the potential growth of aggregate social mobility across different places.
Yeah, that's an important and difficult question. I don't think we have great evidence along those lines. What you're describing in the context of the grammar schools is basically a debate about tracking, I think. So do you want to take kids who are doing well and really help them do extremely well by putting them in a separate environment, or do you want to pool them with other kids? What that boils down to is whether peer effects, if we just stick to the school example for a moment rather than the neighborhoods, where I really don't think we have evidence on this yet. In the context of schools, we want to understand whether peer effects are kind of linear in the sense that every extra high-performing child you have in a classroom ends up helping the low-income kids, or is it that, you know, if you have some children who are doing relatively well but not the top performers, it ends up not affecting the equilibrium very much. I don't think we have a great deal of evidence on that. One thing that comes to mind is there's some evidence from work by Eddie Lazier that if you take children, the children who really have significant peer effects are at the other end of the distribution, kids who end up disrupting the classroom. That affects the extent to which everyone is learning quite substantially. And so giving those children additional help in the form of additional classroom aid, or perhaps teaching them in a separate environment where they can get additional assistance, that type of tracking could potentially be beneficial. On the gifted programs, I think there is evidence that the gifted programs at the high end of the distribution do have pretty significant impacts on those kids' outcomes in the long run. But what that does to the children who are left behind, I think we know less about.
Can you pass the mic just behind you?
I can pass it.
It's on. Yeah.
Okay, it's on. Thank you so much for being here. My name is Bianca, and I was curious when you talked about the possibility of the government saving money in providing vouchers to families with very young kids, in the sense that those kids will eventually make more income and will be paying back the government in income taxes. And to me, I thought that this almost seem to sound like the kids are sort of paying back what they were given or whatever benefits they were given. And I wonder if you think that this could possibly undermine social mobility at all. If, say, for instance, those kids would have been on the margin of some sort of tax exemption, and being in a more mobile position actually is making them pay more taxes, or if you think that there's a possibility for maybe perhaps a more distributive, redistributive way of doing this, or if that's the way it would be.
So you're right that the kids paying more taxes obviously means that there's less money left for them, and so in a sense that's reducing social mobility relative to what we could have achieved. But you have to remember that the amount they're paying in taxes is actually very small relative to the additional amount that they're earning per year. So the typical tax rate for people at the low end of the income distribution is something on the order of 10% or 15% typically, right? So you earn $1,000 extra or, you know, $2,000 extra, you do pay $300 extra to the government per year, but you're getting to keep $1,700 of that, right? So the way you want to think about this is not that you're actually worse off because you've somehow lost eligibility for some program and now are losing a great deal. The way to think about it is you're sharing each dollar with the government, basically, as is always the case in a tax system. And I think while it's true that that reduces social mobility somewhat, that's an inherent feature of having taxes, income taxes, that we're going to use to finance all of these programs, right? And so I actually think that it's kind of a nice feature that you, in a sense, benefited from the government investing in you when you were young, and you're automatically paying back a portion of the returns that you got. It actually feels like a very logical way to set it up.
Okay, let's take two more questions, and then I think we should draw it to a close. So the gentleman here, and then the gentleman at the end of the row there. So let's start with the gentleman down here first, and then go down.
Thank you. You know, you mentioned with the MTO study that there was a take-up of only 50% of the vouchers offered. I mean, that to me suggests strongly that teacher interventions are the way to go, because you're going to get twice the bang for your buck right away.
Well, but actually, you know, the take-up rate doesn't affect your bang for the buck, because the 50% who didn't take it up, you're not paying any money for those people, because you only paid the money for the voucher for the 50% who took it up. Nevertheless, you don't want to have an incredibly low take-up rate. You want to think about why take-up is so low. And in fact, the experiments that I was describing that we're conducting at the moment are targeted at trying to understand why take-up is low and how you might be able to get more families interested in moving to these areas. We suspect that part of what's going on is not that families don't want to move to these places, but part of it might be resistance from the landlords. So landlords often don't want to rent to people who are receiving housing assistance when they have the choice to rent to other people, because they're worried about damage to the apartment or not getting rent paid, et cetera. And so we're trying to think about how you might intervene on the landlord side to make this more attractive to them by giving them an insurance fund or incentives to rent their apartments to voucher holders.
I'm sorry if I can squeeze in just one more quick question. Are there case studies which show how these effects work on the ground?
There is ethnographic work. There's some really interesting work by Stephanie DeLuca at Hopkins showing case studies of families that have moved and the experiences they've had. There are books about the Moving to Opportunity experiment interviewing these families. And a lot of that qualitative work is consistent with the quantitative evidence I'm showing you here.
Okay, so final question at the back here.
Hi, thanks. Hello. Thanks for the lecture.
Yeah.
I was just wondering how some states in the U.S. can justify the salaries paying the teachers as a function of their experience rather than their performance.
It's not unique to teachers. That's a very common policy in unionized professions, that pay is based on experience rather than on performance. And I think that's partly because it's difficult to perfectly determine who the higher performing and lower performing teachers or, you know, workers are in any setting. And you can see how that would create tension within a union if we say, you know, you're doing really well and I'm not, and we're going to pay different amounts. And so I think that naturally leads to a policy that has more uniformity. And so I don't think, you know, in a way that has some benefits. It provides more stability and more insurance, basically, to teachers. So it's not a system that has, you know, no benefits at all. But I think moving a little bit in the direction of what we have in most corporate settings, where you are rewarded somewhat for good performance, would be quite valuable.
Okay, can you join me in thanking Raj?